Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Welcome, everyone. I've got a bit of a cold today, if I sound silly, and I'll try to sniffle and cough off microphone for you. But I want to say thank you to all of the new listeners. Really, it's gone gangbusters. This has been a great first month for the show. I've got literally thousands of listeners, which is wonderful. So I'm really happy to have you all out there. The show seems to be one of the most popular paranormal shows on Blog Talk right now, which is great because we have lots of wonderful guests. We've had a lot of fun with our past guests, and we will have a lot of fun tonight. Luckily, I've been able to get to know a lot of great people, and tonight's no exception. We've got Paula Harris. You may have heard of her, especially if you're in Europe, because she does a lot of talking in European countries. She does some around the United States. She's in really most of the UFO conferences in the state, especially in the last year. She'll be at the UFO Congress. In fact, she's one of the board members of the UFO Congress coming up at the end of the month here, which is the largest UFO symposium or conference of the year, which is great. And I went there last year and got to meet a lot of great people through her, so that was wonderful. We've been friends for a while now. I was doing her website for a while, but she started off with, and this is what I really want to talk about, amongst many other things, she's gotten to know and interview a lot of really interesting people in the field. She likes to stick with whistleblowers. And her start was with J. Allen Hynek. And we'll talk more about him in a second if you're not familiar with him. And I'm surprised that really he isn't more of a household name, especially when it comes to UFOs. And that we don't see him like in the documentaries as much as we should, because he's kind of the father of the whole field, and his story's just amazing. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about some of the other people she's gotten to know and become friends with. Michael Wolf Cravant, we'll talk about, who says that he was part of MJ-12 and was working with the insiders. Also, Colonel Corso, who was a colonel in the Army, and he indeed was, among other things, such as being in charge of nuclear missiles at one point in his career and working in the White House with the president. He was also in charge of the desk of foreign technology for the Army, in which point he was given some foreign technology from who knows where, from the crash in Roswell. And he talks about how a lot of that stuff was reverse engineered and how that really started our big technology boom that we have going on right now, which I think makes sense. We'll see if you agree with that. So it's going to be a great show. I'm really excited about it. Paula's from Italy. She's doing most of her journalistic work out there, and she's a lot of fun. So that's going to be great. But to start off, let's talk about some UFOs in the news. Some big stories, not as many stories as usual, it seems, this week. Last week, we had a lot of them. But this week, just like always, Britain's still going UFO crazy. And a couple of the stories that have come out regarding 2008 and how many UFOs were seen. They're talking about sightings doubling in Britain in last year. Some of the sightings that they've talked about, for some reason, what's interesting is, as I've talked about, Britain is releasing UFO files, and they're doing this periodically. And so it's like the media picks up on one new story every week or other week or once a month and really run with it. And the story that they picked up and ran with this week was UFOs being seen February 12th over the Houses of Parliament out there. So they've got stories on that. Remember, I post these stories on my UFOthinktank.com. You can go there and see those stories. You can also go to my Facebook to see those when I post them. And you could also go to Yahoo Groups and look up UFO Think Tank to find that and get on the email list if you want to be emailed on a regular basis some of the UFOs in the news. So a couple stories regarding this that you'll see posted out there. Moving from Britain to British Columbia, an interesting interview out there with George Norrie. So you're probably familiar with George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, one of the most popular radio shows in the world. Overnight, they talk about paranormal. And actually, our guest tonight, Paula Harris, is probably George Norrie's favorite ufologist. Whenever he's talking UFOs, he brings Paula Harris on to give him the scoop. He doesn't call me. I've never been on with him. He doesn't call MUFON, the largest organization. He doesn't call George Knapp. He doesn't call anybody but Paula Harris, just to give you some insight on how vast her knowledge is and how respected her opinion is. So this is going to be a great night. So we'll put that story up. You're going to be able to look at that. They pretty much asked him, you know, are aliens among us? Do you think they're walking around that, you know, the guy standing next to you might be a alien in disguise? And he says, yes, that's what he believes. So we'll ask Paula her opinions on that, and we'll talk about why she thinks maybe he reached that conclusion. And then another story that I think is really neat that I'm going to put up is 20 Questions with Paula Harris. So I'll post that in just a minute, too, and it's on an Australian news site, which is interesting. So we'll ask Paula about that site and how that interview came about, and you'll be able to read more about her from this link. So there's some UFOs in the news, some big stuff, not as many stories as usual, but I'm sure Paula's got some more scoops she can share with us. So let's start in. Paula, are you there?
Yeah, I am. How are you, Alejandro?
There
How
she
you
is. I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. What is this thing about George Norrie? I just volunteer. It's like volunteer work wherever I am all over the world. It's like I'm reporting. So, you know, you've been on Coast to Coast, too. You've been on with
Norrie, though. Norrie's the big guy.
Well, you're on weekends. I don't think he's on weekends.
Yeah. But how did that come about? Let's start talking about that. How did you become, because it does seem, I mean, from my perspective, that when something happens in the UFO world, he gives you a call and he wants to talk to you about it. Even the Stan Romanek thing or some of the later events, which is great. That's really cool. How did you get to have such a great relationship with him?
Can I tell you a long story? I mean, it's a long story short.
Go for it.
I'll tell you, it's a paranormal story, too. You'll just love this.
Cool.
When I was in Roswell some years ago, and I was doing some research, I saw in the bookstore the name of Richard Hoagland. And I didn't know who I Hoagland was. I mean, the name was familiar. And so what happened was I was supposed to leave Roswell. I'd finished everything. And I thought, well, I wonder who this guy is. And I saw the picture of Mars on the cover of his books. And the people at the bookstore said, well, you know, he just moved here to New Mexico. You might want to interview him. And I thought, well, I'm leaving. I don't think that's going to happen. But they said, here's his fax. So why don't you send him a fax? So I sent him a really quick fax. And Richard sent his agent at the time to call me at the hotel at the Sallyport, and he said, you get on up here right now. You have the story of a lifetime. And this man that was his agent said, I'm going to pick you up, he said, at the Albuquerque airport. I'll be driving a green car. You sit on your luggage. because neither one of us knew what we would look like, right? I mean, and my colleague said, you're out of your mind. You just interviewed Clifford Stone. I mean, you did some very, you know, possibly dangerous stuff, and you're going to go and sit on your luggage at the Albuquerque airport and get in a green car with a strange man and drive into the mountains to find Richard Hoagland. And so I did that. I mean, you know, it was courageous because I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know who the guy was. So I knock on this door of this A-frame somewhere in the Sandia Mountains, and this very distinguished gray-haired guy comes to the door, and he says to me, do you know why you're here? And I said, no. And he said, well, I talked to my psychic in New Jersey, and he said that someone from Italy was going to contact me. and my jaw dropped, and I said, but what do you do? I said, I just saw your books, but what do you do? He said, and he began to tell me about Sidonia and everything. And he said, well, I'm on, you know, Nightline tonight because I'm asking NASA to do a second, a second flyby of, you know, so that we can see Sidonia. Because they had, with the Malin camera, they had one more chance to get a nice picture of Sidonia. And he sent 1,000 faxes to NASA. And what happened was it blocked their, you know, fax machine, and they did do that second flyby. So he gave me an incredible interview, and as he's talking to me, he says, you've got to be on George Murray. And I said, what is this? I never stay up that late. I don't know how people stay. Quite frankly, I don't know how people stay up that late. So I didn't know this show. And I can honestly tell the listeners that Richard Hoagland has done more for me in my career. It has been the sweetest, most wonderful person that has ever worked with me, except he will not endorse any of my books. He will not write anything because he doesn't want to be involved with anything that has a UFO on the cover. Now, if I would write a book that didn't have a UFO on the cover, Richard would write something nice about me in the book. But since my books have UFOs on the cover and he doesn't want to be involved with the quote-unquote UFO community, all Richard had done that really helped us, because even George said in our last interview, I thank Richard Hoagland for having introduced us, and that's it. Every time I'm on there, Richard always sends his love anyway, so I have to thank Richard Hoagland, to make a long story short.
Yeah, well, he's definitely a big guy. George Norrie is a big fan of Richard Hoagland as well, because he has him on a lot also. But just for the listeners who don't know who Richard Hoagland is, and you can fill in the gaps for me, he used to be a media person for NASA?
What he did, he started out being Walter Cronkite's science advisor on the station that I don't remember the station that Walter Cronkite was on, but he was his science advisor, and then he worked at the Goddard Center, the NASA Goddard Center, and he also worked at several planetariums, and he was living in New Jersey at the time. And Richard Hoagland, if you look at, for instance, the book on John McDonald, the famous physicist that, you know, was part of the, you know, people that wanted to blow open the UFO story. He's in all those old UFO books. There's pictures of a young Richard Hoagland. So we know for a fact that Richard Hoagland initially was interested in UFOs. Mm. Then he got interested in Egypt and worked with Graham Hancock and Robert Bouval and wrote books with them. And then when the Malin camera went by Mars and photographed Sidonia, Richard Hoagland, for me, is amazing because he's one of the people who can connect the dots really well. He saw a correlation between Sidonia, the hyper-dimensional geometry, and Egypt, and he just left the field of ufology. He said, I think it was a little hard, you know, for him to deal with some of the ufologists in the field. They aren't always all that friendly.
I've noticed that once in a while. And, you know, I got to admit, too, and it's like this, I think, you know, it's like this in business. I think a lot of people who work as professionals out there would agree. There is a good old boy network wherever you go. And because this is such a male-centric field, because it's, you know, just like I'm putting together the Roswell Talks, and you keep telling me you have to get women. And I do want to, but there's not a lot of women in the field out there right now.
Well, I want, you know, one of my heroes, and I'm going to say it on, you know, on your show, is Angela Joyner. I mean, I think, you know, I was so happy when there was another woman in the field. I'm one of those people that want more women, and I feel that
yeah, I want more women too.
It's more fun. I think it's more fun. I don't believe in this competition, backbiting, backstabbing, you know, debunking kind of thing. I have fun with the other researchers, and you know that,
right,
Alejandro. We've gone to conference together, and we have fun. I mean, it's sharing information. In the end, Alejandro, I think you're a lot like me. You know, it's not about us.
Right.
It's not about us. It's about the phenomenon. It's
mm-hmm.
about what's out there.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So then let's get into Australia. What is this Australian thing you just did? Is this like an Australia news site? Did they get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, I don't even know how I met the gentleman that asked me to do it. His name is Dennis Whitley, and he lives in California, but he has started a UFO kind of news site in an Australian internet site. And it was quite hard to do because he, instead of, you know, interviewing me like you're doing, he gave me 20 questions to type
mm-hmm.
out, to fill out. And when I have to type out 20 questions and I have to think about the answers, you know, it took me about 2 days to fill in those answers. And usually it's 10 questions, it's not 20. But I don't know if you know that, but whenever I do something with George Nuri, they send me questions. They ask me to make up their questions also. Because what they want to do is have an easy flow on the show. In other words, they don't want to they want to go somewhere with what you're doing. They want to promote your book. They want to promote your research. And since they don't know that, they ask you to make up the questions so that they can, you know, give you the most exposure on your own personal research. Otherwise, you're calling somebody up and I've had this happen to me. They say, like, who are you and what do you do? And it's like, whoa, you didn't read my website? You haven't read one of my books? You have to start with my whole life story again. So, you
right.
know, the thing is, he asked, you know, gave me the 20 questions that included everything from the Vatican to Colonel Corso to whether I believe in good and bad aliens. And the last question, I think, is on cattle mutilations, which just floored me, because I'm the last one that knows anything about cattle mutilations. And they were done so well, and the photographs were so good because, you know, I swear to God, I've got about 4,000 photographs of all the major players in ufology because I'm a photographer. I take all my own pictures. I take all, you know, every time we go somewhere, I may be doing a lecture, but I'm also doing the story. So I write for an Italian magazine called X Times. Before that, it was called Area 51. And when I do a story and I have to report on something, I take their pictures. I've got pictures of Timothy Good and you know, Stanton. I've got pictures of everybody in the world. I mean, I have an archive, but they're my pictures. So they used my own photography in the story. I guess that's why the story looks so good.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed you take a lot of pictures. You're like Japanese tourists out there, which I've been able to benefit from because even, you know, on my Facebook, I have a couple pictures there that you took that, thank goodness that you prompted me to do that, or I wouldn't have a picture of me with
Streber.
Or possibly with you and Peckman and Gort. I love that picture.
Yeah, but I have a picture of you with Richard Hoagland.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I do. And you should put that on there, yeah, because you helped him with his, you know, you should tell the audience, when Richard came to speak to the Libertarian Party, he gave a very great lecture here on his new book. And so what happened was that he couldn't get all the phone equipment together, the microphone and everything, and you helped him with all that.
Yeah. You know, and I would tell the people, too, if that was a great experience. Nobody in the area knew that he was coming to speak for the Libertarian Party, which was funny, and in Denver. So we got to be there with a pretty small crowd, and I know a lot of people have asked me, where did you see Richard Hoagland? Because people would love to see him. And, you know, when I went in, I was a little skeptical. I know his work. I know I've read a lot of his work, and he's done some great work actually catching NASA, or at least Jet Propulsion Laboratories, Richard Malin's group, photoshopping pictures and changing pictures and not releasing all the pictures. So I thought that was great, but a lot of his claims, I was like, But we went to see him talk. He's one of the best presenters out there. He's just an incredible presenter. He's great. He's a lot of fun to listen to. So if anybody has a chance to go see Richard Hoagland talk, definitely do it. But we don't see him at a lot of conferences because his talks come at a premium.
Well, also, he talks for about 3 hours, and he won't cut it down to an hour. That's the problem with Richard. He spoke at the first X conference, and there was 1,000 people in the room. You couldn't hear a pin drop, I swear. But he went on, and it went into 3 hours. And people would get up to walk out, and he'd go, "You're going to miss something. You better sit back down." Embarrassing. And I thought, well, but he gets standing ovations whenever Richard talks. I mean, you're right. He's a great speaker. You can't fall asleep. It's just that it's for a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, let's go back in the past and talk about your beginnings, because not a lot of people, too few people know about J. Allen Hynek. And, you know, you can add more to this if there's prior, but really J. Allen Hynek is how you got into the field, isn't he?
Yeah, well, actually, nobody. I can't imagine anybody wanting to do what we do. I mean, it's so weird. I went to see the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I was a teacher. I had two kids. You know, I was in my 30s, and I had seen the film, and I had an emotional reaction to it. And then I happened to be concurrently teaching science fiction at a high school here, and realized that you know, Hynek had been the consultant to Spielberg on doing the film, and I realized that he had a Center for UFO Studies in Evanston, Illinois. I happened to be at a wedding there, and I stopped by the Center of UFO Studies because I wanted to see all the files, those files that came out of the Blue Book, because, you know, Hynek was initially hired by the Air Force to debunk all those sightings and call them swamp gas and everything else in the world. And Alan, at the time, he accepted. He had five kids, wife, and, you know, that the Air Force was paying him to do this. A lot of people would do the same thing. And then he realized that some of this was real. And I think his conscience got the better of him. And he took the files that were unexplainable and started CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, which I think is still going in Evanston. And what happened was that when I went there, he came from around the corner with his pipe, his famous pipe. You see a cameo of him in Close Encounters. You know, when the aliens land, you see him coming, you know, out from where the scientists are with his pipe. And he said to me, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yes, I'm really interested in these files. And do you have any sightings in Italy? I'm Italian. I can translate them for you." And that started a relationship of about 6 years where I worked with him. He gave me the files. And another thing I did, which, you know, people have heard about, is I had a big map on the wall, and every time there were sightings, he'd call me on the phone. I was putting pins in this map so I could see where the flaps were. He'd say, "You have to, you know, it happened here and here." The same UFO, the same night, he would get these reports where it would come down from Michigan, and it would be in Ohio, and, you know, and then he began coming to Boulder. And he came to Boulder several times. He was on television. I have a story for you, Alejandro, though. I remember one time he came to Boulder. He was supposed to speak on Nightline, and the famous debunker, what was his name?
Phil Klass.
Phil Klass, yeah, he was supposed to debate him. And I remember Alan saying to me, "You get on the phone, Paula, and you tell them, no way will I talk to Phil Klass. No way. I am not interested." And I didn't even, at the time, I didn't even know who Phil Klass was. I mean, so I told them on the show there that Dr. Hynek would not speak to Phil Klass. Because evidently, I mean, he was very, very, very brutal about debunking. You know, so, I mean, that's the only time I ever saw Alan Hynek get angry, because he was, like, really mild-mannered and would do, I was with him a lot of times when he'd question contactees, and the contactee would talk about a sighting they had had, like, in Golden, Colorado or something, and I would listen. At the time, I didn't want to touch contactee material because I thought it was too weird for me. I was nuts and bolts. So I didn't, you know, I couldn't digest that people would actually be taken up and so forth. It took me 30 years to even touch the contactee scenario.
Yeah. Well, I love Hynek. I mean, he's absolutely one of my favorite characters in this whole scenario. One thing that I find with him, and we'll see if you agree with this, and with other great, brilliant minds, because I know you are friends with John Mack, and he's someone who's similar in this arena, or Jack Vallee, I think, is the same. There's no cut and dry answer to this phenomena with them. With Hynek, and you read his books, and I think people get frustrated with these sort of conclusions, but he leaves everything open. You know, it could be a lot of different things, not definitely defining, here's what's happening, we got these great guys coming in this kind of craft from Zeta Reticuli. He's open to the multidimensional possibility. Same with John Mack. Can you speak on that a bit? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, but I didn't know that Alan Hynek had taken pictures of a UFO from an airplane window. I didn't know that. Clifford Stone told me that, and he told me what book to find it in.
Oh, I know. I don't think anybody really but there's been that rumor going around, but he didn't claim those pictures, right?
I don't know if he claimed, but he told me it was in a particular book. Clifford told me what book it was in and the photographs and that Hynek. I think there was a hidden side to Alan. I think Alan knew much more than he could talk about. Mm-hmm. No, he never said what it was, but I remember him when he would come here, he would listen to opera. He was into opera a lot, and he would, I would watch him, and he'd be smoking his pipe in a chair and listening to opera. And I remember one time he looked at me and said, God, I hope I get the answer before I die. He said, I really want to know what's going on.
Uh-huh.
And then when he got, you know, he was ill with the brain tumor, and I felt so bad. You know, he would call and say, I'm getting better, I'm getting better. And he would call, because then he had moved by that time down to Scottsdale, Arizona. And I had gone down there to visit him and Mimi, his wife. And, you know, it was quite difficult because I knew he wanted to know. But and Jacques Vallée won't pronounce himself either, because I really think it's a difficult scenario to put a bottom line. My new book, All of the Above, is about that, because George keeps trying to nail me down on what's happening, and I always say it's interdimensional, it's physical, it's also interplanetary. It's all of it. I mean, you get these light beings. People see light beings appearing in their living room, and they're all light, and they look like humanoid figures. I mean, where do you want to tell me that's coming from? You tell me that's coming off of a spaceship, or is it another dimension, or is it an angel, or what all is it? So I think that it's so complex and so complicated that anybody that thinks they have the answer really doesn't have the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that one. If someone says, and I think a lot of people tell you this, if you go to a meeting where you have a presenter and the first thing they say is they've got it all figured out and they're going to tell you how it is, they most likely are one of the people who have the least amount of information or really have it figured out. So,
you know, I wanted to tell you something else, too. In my book, All of the Above, I've got a chapter called Alien Racism. And it's about this deal about the grays and bad, good aliens, and let's like put a label on them, and the reptilians are horrible, and you know, all of this stuff. And I basically can't play that game, because I started looking at even the reptilian situation, and when I was sitting with a Native American shaman, she said to me, why would you ever say things like that when our ancient ones from our cultures are called the serpent people? And they're the wisest of our culture. And then I remembered Quetzalcoatl down in Mexico, you know, the serpent king. Mm-hmm. And this and their legends are very, these people are supposed to be the wise ones in their, and here I am already racist calling them the evil ones because we've been brainwashed to think the devil is like this and so forth and serpent and God, you know, it's, you can't do this with the alien races. They're just different races from different places, and they have their own agenda, whether it be good, bad, or indifferent. I think the big job for researchers, and this is the advice I'd give young researchers, is don't come to any conclusions because we have no idea what their agenda is, because we don't think like these people. We don't think like them. They are not human.
Right. And then I love that concept too, the whole racism. That's really funny because nobody brings that up. You're right. People want to define and classic good, bad, you know, and they want definitely definitive motives for everyone. But, I mean, if you were to take humans or even Americans and or any group of people, it would be difficult to do that sort of thing with them.
Well, suppose an alien watched our news report,
mm-hmm.
and suppose they saw pedophile, and suppose they saw murder, and suppose they saw war, and suppose they saw, you know, people stealing and going in to, you know, rob a 7-Eleven, and then they go back to their planet and say, these people are, this is what these people do, and this is supposed to be the vision that they get of humans,
mm-hmm.
you know, that would be totally false, because we report only the bad stuff, and we only see the bad stuff, you know, on,
yeah.
on in our media. So I just don't think that it's very accurate to really pigeonhole anything. And the fact that we, for many, many years, have really commercialized the gray as the alien, when there's, again, the human type that's walking around. You know, the Timothy Good told me, you know, he saw one walk into the hallway of a hotel in London, and other people have told me they've seen these human type. I just got an email from Charles Hall, who says in his books that the human type aliens have 25 teeth, and he just met somebody that qualifies. You know, I didn't realize that there's a whole group of Norwegian type aliens that have only 25 teeth.
Yeah. Well, and we'll get more into some of those. And I wanted to back up a little. So you were working with Hynek. And then how did you get, was your next step getting involved with this Italian? And you met Hynek during that time, to make clear, too. You lived part of your time in Boulder, Colorado, and then part of your time in Italy. And then
I only met Hynek when I was here in Boulder.
Right.
He died. I didn't go to Italy until 1992. He died in 1986.
Okay. Okay,
he died,
gotcha.
Yeah, and he died in 86, and I swore that I was never going to do it again, never do research. People would call my house, and I'd say, I'm not doing any research anymore.
Uh-huh.
I'd send them to other people. I was devastated.
Yeah.
It hurt, so I didn't want to do it. Plus, I didn't have any confidence in myself, and I wasn't going to work by myself. And, you know, it wasn't until I went to Italy, and Roberto Pinotti knew I had worked with Hynek, and he knew Hynek really well, that he pulled me into the limelight in Italy.
And that's when you started writing for the paper out there?
Well, they started to pick my brain about having worked with Hynek. So, you know, Roberto Pinotti is the head of the CUN, the Centro Ufologico Nazionale, which is the MUFON of Italy. I mean, they're very much like MUFON. They do the archiving of sightings, and they do, you know, physical traces cases and so forth. And he said, you work with Hynek, you have to be with us. You must write for our magazine. You must investigate cases here in Italy. Because I was already, then I was teaching at the American Overseas School. And so they dragged me all over the place into conferences. I brought Mimi over, Alan's wife, and she got a special award. You know, I brought Mimi Hynek over to Italy to get a special award. I brought Padre Balducci, Monsignor Balducci from the Vatican, over to the X conference, accompanied him so he could get an award. Like, I bring these people across the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how did all that start? What were some of those first? I'm sure there were some interesting cases you ran into in Italy, and probably the area.
Well, Italy has a lot of sightings. For instance, I was in Italy when we had sightings over Fiumicino, you know, Leonardo da Vinci Airport, and a green sphere, like the, but not as clear as the O'Hare case where they saw the craft, sitting over the airport. And we had a lot of sightings near the ocean, near Pescara, near the Adriatic Sea. And I would read the accounts and talk to the people. And, you know, they're very honest. I mean, they tell you what they see. They have no ulterior motives. The other thing that happened in Italy, which I was shocked about, was that we would have this major conference in San Marino every year. We've been top major American researchers over. But one particular conference, we had the Air Force there. The Italian Air Force that was actually giving the files was talking about the fact they were very confused. They couldn't... they couldn't really know what it was, but here were the cases. So that was the first time in my life I ever saw military entity like the Air Force come out and use the word UFOs and be at a UFO conference.
Wow.
He had his uniform on.
What year was that?
It was, if I had to guess, it was around 1999.
Wow.
The name of the military man was Ferraro. He was representing Italy. The Italian Air Force, and he had his uniform on. It's almost like if one of our Air Force people here came to a MUFON conference and reported on the military cases that that our Air Force had in America. The only difference is anything we get in America, and you know this, Alejandro, comes from the Freedom of Information. They don't volunteer it. They don't say, here are the files. You have to, like, ask for them.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes they give you the runaround like we've ran across. But certainly, Air Force, you're very welcome to come to MUFON. We would love to have you there. That would be cool. So then, did you begin to work with other European countries? Because I know you do a lot of talking and going all over Europe.
Well, what happened is that I became very close to Monsignor Balducci, as you
mm-hmm.
remember, the Vatican priest that came out and said that it was okay to believe in UFOs, it wasn't against your religion, and also he would cite passages from the Bible where he would say Jesus was the king of the universe. In other words, in the Bible, the words king of the universe appear 66 times, and the universe means that there's other beings out there. If he's king of, not king of empty planets, he's king of planets that have somebody on them. So, you know, Balducci had collected all this stuff. And because I lived alone in Italy, you know, in an apartment two blocks away from him, he would ask me to come over for dinner, but I didn't realize he was doing this. And he would put the tape recorder on the table and ask me everything I do, you know, Area 51. He wanted to know all that. He asked me about the cases I was working on, about, you know, a lot of stuff, Colonel Corso. And he would tape me, and then I saw that he had thousands of newspapers he was reading. He was, like, kind of absorbing all the UFO material all over the world. So that when he was invited to Switzerland, I went with him to Switzerland and spoke. And I went with him to Switzerland twice. I also was in Marseille, France. I was in Belgium. And I got to, you know, go to these different places. And even George Neri started connecting me with the Vatican. Now, I am not a representative of the Vatican. Absolutely. I just know about these things because of the talks I had with Balducci.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I saw him even recently. It's too bad that he just passed away this last year, right?
Yeah.
Which is very sad. He's a wonderful guy. And I saw him in an interview. There's a new John Mack documentary out there. I know you could get it at UFOTV.com. I think Tim from UFOTV is actually distributing it, which is great because it's a wonderful. It's called Touched, and he's in part of this. I think, yeah, I still need to get you.
I was present when he did that.
Oh, were you? Cool.
Yeah, what happened was the John Max people contacted me. And actually, Lauren Chittle. She was a producer. Mm-hmm. And I was living in an apartment in Rome, and, you know, she said, I need to do an interview there, and I said, but I don't know you guys. I don't know if I should take you over. I mean, anytime somebody just wants to go over and see Balducci, I've got to know who it is because, He trusts me. He trusts me implicitly, and I can't just bring anybody I don't know over. So she said, we're doing a movie for John Mack, and, you know, would you come over? I mean, would you let us go over? And so I took her over. I took her and Andy, the cameraman. Mm-hmm. And Andy's picture is in my book, Connecting the Dots, for cameramans, because when those two finished filming Monsignor Balducci, he pulled off the champagne, went down and got a cake, and we had this little party. I mean, he loved people, so there's a picture in my Connecting the Dots of Andy holding a champagne glass and, you know, Balducci's partying with us. So,
that's,
you know, just really... Yeah, and I would like to see what the finished product is, so I have not seen that film.
Yeah, I've got it, yeah. So we got to get together and show that to you, because it came out great. And the clip that I'm talking about, he's very clear. He was the Vatican's head demonologist, right?
Right.
So he must have been very involved. I think his life would be interesting, because he must have been involved with exorcism and things like this. And he even looks like... you know, the guy in The Exorcist.
Well, you know, one of the questions they asked him was, you know, because this gets thrown at me a lot, even on George Nury. You know, could these...
That's where I was going.
Yeah, people come from the devil, you know, the evil. Uh-huh. And he very clearly, I don't know, did he say in the documentary,
the devil
doesn't need UFOs.
Right, the devil doesn't need UFOs. These aren't demons, you know. These are something separate from demons. These are different people that are out there living in space. And he says something. It ends really funny, because it ends with a translation, the English translation, you know, going through and saying, you know, you've got to understand these guys are here. If you don't, your eyes are closed and you're being stupid or something like that. And then there's a pause, and then you hear him say, "Estúpida." And that's how the clip ends. So.
I know. You know, I miss him so much. You can't believe this, but I can't. It's like I can't take it. I was very close to Alan Hynek, and I suffered so much when he died. And then I was very close to Colonel Corso, and I suffered so much when he died. Now Colonel Corso and John Mack, who was a very close friend of mine. So, you know, when these people pass on, you know, there are people, you know, even with John Mack, he was in my apartment in Rome. So, you know, we'd sit there and we'd have dinner. I rode with him on a train. I spent some time in Newport with him. You know, when these people, you know, pass on, it's really hard on me. It's you know, they're the best of the best. These guys were incredible.
Yeah, John Mack, he's number one in my book. But let's get on to Colonel Corso, because the way you met him is also a great story.
It's all paranormal. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So here we go. Is it paranormal? Yeah, I was. It's in my book, Connecting the Dots. I was in Rome and writing for the magazine, and it was the 50th anniversary of Roswell, and my boss says to me, "We want you to cover it because this book is coming out that's, you know, astronomical. You got to go and find this Colonel Corso person." And I had just been trying to survive a failed love affair there. I was, like, totally depressed and did not want to leave the country, certainly didn't want to go to Roswell, certainly didn't want to do anything. And from Boulder, Colorado, comes a fax from Richard Sigismund. I don't know if you know him. He's an amazing researcher, a friend of Hynek's here. And Richard had said, "Well, no, we're waiting for Paula. We have a van. You know, we will transport her." In fact, I drove there. It was like an 8-hour. I drove with them in the van. And since I wasn't prepared
from Boulder to Roswell?
From Boulder to Roswell.
Oh, my gosh. That's a long drive.
Richard says to me, "Yeah, I know. We'll never forget that trip." And I kept saying to Richard, you know, because they said, "Well, we're staying in Artesia." And I said, "I can't do this story from Artesia. That's 40 miles away. You know, what am I going to come in for the press conference 40 miles away? You know, I have to be here the whole time." So when I walked into the press club there, the press people said, "You know, you can do it, but you have to, we don't have a place for you to stay. You can look in the phone book and find, you know, start calling all the hotels." Well, the first hotel I called was the Sallyport Inn, and which were everybody was. I mean, from Linda Howe to Bud Hopkins to Travis Walton to the whole gang there, we're all staying there. And I call them, and they had a room for three nights, the three nights that I was there, and the room was smack next to Colonel Philip Corso.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't call that a coincidence, I don't know what is.
And then so you, like, bumped into him in the hallway.
No, I didn't know what he looked like. So I went to the hotel and dumped my stuff, and I got in a car, red sports car, with somebody I met who happened to be Bill Burns, and got a ride over to this red sports car over to the UFO Museum. I didn't know I was in the car with Bill Burns, his co-writer. I just knew it was a New Yorker that gave me a ride to the UFO Museum. And there was Philip Corso sitting at a table, you know, on the stage with then Bill Burns went, and I realized who it was. And I'm sitting there saying, how am I going to get an interview with this man? Well, everybody in the world wants one. I mean, there were so many cameras, I can't even tell you. And then this blonde guy next to me says, you're from Italy. And I said, yes. He said, ask my father a question in Italian. I said, who's your father? He says, Colonel Corso. he speaks Italian, and I didn't want to do it. And this guy takes his hand literally and pushes me into the crowd, because I knew all cameras would I was timid, plus all the cameras would be pointing on me. And I did. I asked him in Italian about the Santelli footage, and he answered me. You know, the autopsy film? And he said to me about the autopsy film, your listeners might be interested in hearing this. He said, if that isn't a real film, it's a copy of a real film, he says, because I had that upper lid of the alien in my files with the artifacts. He said that was like a covering that was peeled off the eye, because in the autopsy film, you see him peeling it off, and there's a pupil. He said, and we used to use that for looking around in the dark, because from that, we back-engineered night screening devices. So I thought, oh, my God, so that film could be real. And then he said to me, afterwards he saw me and he said to me, I need to speak to you. He said that to me. I said, well, I need to speak to you. I would like you to come to Italy, and I'm supposed to interview you and all this. And he said, we'll find a way. And then when I went back to my hotel, I saw him walk into the room next to me. And I said, oh, my God, this is like the biggest coincidence of my whole life. And he wasn't supposed to speak to anybody. So the next morning he came, knocked on the door of my room with two books and said, I'll give you an interview, but you got to take these books to my army buddies in Italy, this man named Raffanelli that he was in the Second World War with him. And he had me bring these autograph books back to Italy, gave me an incredible interview. I was probably one of the only ones that was just one-on-one with him, because everybody, I remember, tried to get an interview. And Simon & Schuster at that time was just not wanting him to do much talking. So, and actually, Alejandro, he didn't do much talking here in the United States. He spoke in Italy. He came to Italy twice with his grandchildren. I was the guide. I took them around Rome. I was with him. I was like his bodyguard the whole time. And so that changed my life. I mean, being with a man that talked about this as being perfectly normal, having taken part in this cover-up, and admitting that the young people could handle it and the young people needed to know the truth, changed my whole entire existence the way Alan Hynek did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think his story is really incredible. But then you went on to help him get his book translated into Italian?
Well, that's what we did. Well, when he came over, the book was so amazing, because the book is, I mean, it admits to things we never knew about, that we translated the day after Roswell, Giorno dopo Roswell, and I wrote the preface. I mean, the deal Curl made is I want Paula involved in all of it, so... You know, I wrote the preface, and so I'm Strom Thurman. I'm the Strom Thurman in Italy. And then he said to Maurizio, my boss, he said, by the way, Maurizio Baiada will be speaking at Laughlin. He's my boss. He's the editor of X Times. But he said to him, I'm going to give you my original notes, he said, because there's been some criticism of inaccuracies, you know. And there's a few inaccuracies because, you know, it was co-written by Bill Burns, who put some things about Roswell in there, I guess, I don't know what, but that may not be accurate. And that causes the debunkers or the detractors of Colonel Corso to throw the baby out with the bathwater. He's not even talked about in Roswell. He's criticized heavily by a lot of people because of five or six inaccuracies there. And, you know, so he gave us his personal notes, Alejandro. I mean, his handwritten notes, which Maurizio published in a separate book called The Dawn of a New Age, and you can buy that book at any bookstore in Italy. You go to any bookstore, Dawn of a New Age by Colonel Philip Corso is there. I have copies of it. It is his original notes. There are no inaccuracies in that.
Yeah, that's it would be wonderful if we could get that in English. But and the Bill Burns you're referring to, just in case people don't know, is the guy from UFO Magazine. He publishes that, and probably even more famous for right now, the TV show UFO Hunters. And he's the main guy, the little guy with the sunglasses on all the time on the UFO Hunters show. Yeah, and his baseball hat. So,
well,
yeah.
You know, I didn't realize that when Colonel Corso signed the contract, it was a commercialized venture, and a lot of this is commercialized venture, and America deals with a lot of ufology as a commercialized venture. I mean, you know, I always wondered, and this is just Paula talking, why the Roswell people need to be battling among themselves. I was thinking, why don't they all sit down like in a seminar and share their information so we get to the bottom of this?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, I talked to this person and I did this and I did this. Why? What did you do so we could just put the pieces of this puzzle together? So we can, you know, can I share notes with you? Can you tell me what you found out? And
mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what I found out. And my thinking on, and I'm using Roswell as an example on any kind of research, is why can't we all sit in a room and talk about what we found out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's why I have my UFO think tank, the idea of doing exactly that. And your book, Connecting the Dots, and you know, I've heard lots of people refer to it and that whole concept of connecting the dots, people sharing their pieces so we can get down and connect the dots and figure these pieces out. That's why I loved your book. When it first came out, there were some of those people in your book that I didn't know. And so I got to be introduced to some of them. So it was great, you know, for a researcher to be able to take this book and have snippets and pieces of information about all of these different people. So you knew.
I want to add one thing about the book, too. I mean, it was used as a textbook at Arizona, at Scottsdale Community College, because it's word-for-word interviews. But there's some people in my book I didn't agree with, but I still put their story in there. I mean,
right.
There's some research. I mean, one of the people that I absolutely adore is a good friend of mine. We spend a lot of time together is Daryl Sims, but there's a lot of, you know, what Daryl says about the alien abduction situation that I'm not totally in agreement with, but I'm still going to put him in my book. It's not up to me to start censoring people's opinions.
Yeah, yeah, I had the same thing because, you know, another big mentor of mine is Leo Sprinkle, and when I met Daryl Sims, he was like, man, I was telling Leo Sprinkle how it is, and he saw my face. And so, but he's just such a charming person. I've got an interview of him on my website that I did, and it was one of my funnest interviews because he's open to talking, you know, and he's a very charming person and a great speaker.
Oh, I love Daryl. I mean, Daryl and I will be friends forever, you know, and I had to put him in there. And, I put him in there. I put Richard Boylan in there. I put Yvonne Smith in there, but you know, they all have different opinions, and I have to not censor anything. That's why I refuse to, you know, put my own opinion into this thing. It's you who has to decide.
Yeah. So, of course, your life gets stranger and stranger all of the time, and I want to move to one of your more probably most of the stories you cover are very controversial. But another highly controversial story that you've covered, and just recently I got his book, which is so hard to come by, but a friend got me a copy, Gary Huffman, you know him. But Michael Wolf Trevant, and I want to while we're in this section, there's a few people in the chat. You know, if you want to ask some questions in the chat or give us a call here at 646-716-5373, I'll get you on to ask questions. I think I missed a couple of callers that called in because I wasn't paying attention. I apologize for that, but if you want to call in, we've got Mo out there in the chat, and it looks like Grant Cameron is listening in too, so one of both of our favorite
beasts. Oh, he's my favorite. Let me say something publicly.
Mm-hmm.
People who really do their work, people who are really high caliber, people who have the biggest, you know, sense of integrity and really live by a certain principle, that's Grant Cameron. If anybody ever asked me who to invite to a conference and who has some of the best information in this field, who gets along with people, I would recommend Grant Cameron. I think he does a really good job, I mean a really good research job on the presidential situation. I was shocked with how much he got. I didn't know how he got his information because he's got such detailed information on all the president's involvement. I didn't have any idea until he, you know, his research came out. Now, if we ever start a university where we teach this, he has to be one of the professors because his information is documented, it's archived, and, you know, the students that would come to that class would absolutely walk away with a wealth of information.
He just put OMG in the chat, so I think he feels a little embarrassed by the gushing.
Yeah, well, that's great. True, but it's true because, if I had to compare him to other people, it's not about entertainment with him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's about getting the job out done, the work out, and about, doing it correctly, you know.
It's funny, though, because he does have kind of an attitude, it would seem, where it is kind of fun for him. It's a fun hobby.
He allowed something to happen last year, which I was shocked about. Somebody dressed up like, I think it was Hillary Clinton, and came out on his arm at the. Were you there when that happened?
Oh my gosh, no.
It had a Hillary Clinton mask, came out on the, Grant was starting his lecture. They put him at 8:30 in the morning. He should have never been at 8:30. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning. And he had the best lecture, but he came out on the stage with some, I think it was Hillary Clinton, and look-alike, you know, with a mask on his arm.
Oh, that's because I was working during his talk. I didn't get to see his talk.
So that was funny. It was comedian-like.
Funny.
Yeah.
Well, he says 500 years from now, our work will be important history, and we can hope so. But, let's move on. I'm sure he'll have a question around here, too.
Actually, 500—Grant, can we not make it 500 years?
Yeah, hopefully five.
Let's try 100 years from now because I want this to be in the university. I really want—I would like this to be studied. I mean, look at Carl Sagan got an exobiology grant, exobiology classes at Cornell University. All right, mm-hmm. Cornell bought into the exobiology situation, you know, studying life from outer space. Why can't we do exopolitics?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's wrong with that? It's the same thing, only it's the study of the alien presence and all the phenomena from the beginning. So I'm always going to lobby for a university class. I'm a teacher. I have a master's in education. For me, that's what this is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my cousin, actually, you know him, Jason, from Metro State. He works for the school, and he's looking into petitioning to have a sort of class just to open the gate. And I'm really interested in participating in that a petitioning process because maybe then we can duplicate that. Because one thing he's found with starting his paranormal organization on the schools, there's definitely a big interest from college-age kids in this arena.
Well, you know, my book, All of the Above, the foreword, the preface is written by Nick Pope. The foreword is written by a 21-year-old college kid named Brett Smith, the son of Yvonne Smith. It's called The Compassionate Approach to Galactic Diplomacy. A Compassionate Approach to Galactic Diplomacy. That means you don't go in there with both barrels loaded to shoot down a bunch of aliens and that's how you start this. He wrote the most beautiful essay, and I put it as, and he's 21 years old. I put it as the foreword to my book, because in the end, I would like those guys, the young guys, to take this over. They've got the best ideas, and they know how to approach this. They're talking to their own people. I mean, they're talking to other young people. And so my vision is that the young people are going to take this over, and they'll do a great job with it. So I hope your cousin Jason gets that course in. And I'd love to teach something, you know, in that realm.
Yeah. So Michael Wolff.
Oh, Michael Wolff. I was invited to Paul Hellyer, the ex-minister of defense's birthday party. And when I saw him, he grabbed my arm and he said, "You must write a book about Michael Wolff."
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing he said to me. And I
was
said,
that the first time you met him?
No, that was this summer when I went to his party. I know when I went, the first time I met Hellyer was I flew to Canada to do the famous YouTube interview that's on YouTube. I did it on my own because I was originally supposed to be at the University of Toronto lecture. He was there with Richard Doland, Stephen Bassett, Stanton Friedman, and there was supposed to be Paula Harris, but I was in the hospital. I was ill in Italy and never made it. So I thought, I'm not gonna miss this. So I flew to Canada on my own dime to interview him. But this summer when he saw me, he looked at me and he said, "You must write a book about Michael Wolff," because he had gotten inside information on Michael Wolff. Mm. Michael Wolff Cruvant was one of the whistleblowers that was seriously ill, who stayed in his apartment in Connecticut, who when I contacted him to do the interview, I asked permission before I did this interview with Michael Wolff. I asked permission of Jim Courant, who is another, he's a pilot researcher, but he's a pilot. And he had done an interview that Michael had been at Area 51, S4, that Michael, because of his experience as a contactee, this goes right on down the line from Clifford Stone, Colonel Corso, and a lot of other people. These children were contactees and had telepathic abilities and had contact later on in their lives. Michael, because he had telepathic abilities, was asked to be an interface with human-type aliens. In particular, the group that he was involved with was, the name of the being was Sarah. He looked like us. He was blonde-haired, blue eyes. He came from Altair 4. Evidently, this Sarah from Altair 4 was housed at the Area 51 base, and Michael was interfacing that Michael had a telepathic ability, and I can attest to that. He did the strangest things, and we lived through some very strange times. Probably the strangest person I've ever met with Michael Wolff. And so I did this interview because he was also involved in advanced technology. Michael was a scientist. Now, one of the problems with Michael Wolff, since he got most of his degrees in black programs, and he had six PhDs in these black programs. He is highly controversial because his records have disappeared. However, when I went to his house, I photographed the diplomas I saw from the New York Academy of Sciences, from Who's Who and different other places. And when he talked to me, because I have 70 audio interviews with Michael Wolff, he told me where he got these degrees. He told me details about the different universities, how it worked. And he told me about having worked in these black ops programs. He also worked for the CIA. I talked to some intelligence people who said that Michael Wolff definitely worked for the CIA. He had an Italian connection in that he worked in Italy, again, like Colonel Corso, so we were able to track him in Italy. He told me where he stayed. He told me what was around the place he stayed. Like he said, he stayed at the Sporting Hotel across the street with a drugstore. He told me he went to the Spoleto Music Festival, all these things that I could check because I was living in Italy. And my conversations with Michael Wolff took place for a year with phone bills over $1,000 a month, and he would wake me up in the middle of the night and tell me to tape everything because when he was dead, that I had to write a book about this, and he told me that I had to take it, you know, word for word, everything that he said. In other words, there's no way of writing notes. You can't take notes when these people talk to you. So someday I will write a book about Michael Wolff, but the strangest thing about him is that other researchers tried to get to him, and one particular researcher told me that that particular researcher did not want to interview him because he knew too much. Another researcher told me that they couldn't find his paperwork, so they didn't bother. I mean, they did. Of course they couldn't find his paperwork because it was in black ops programs. You're not going to get it. And since Michael has died, I have met people from other countries who knew of his work, verified his work, and one particular person from Canada, Montreal, that went to see Michael, and while this particular person was in Michael's apartment, he was witness to a gray being that came out of Michael's bedroom. Now, that sounds weird, but it's not, because when I went to see Michael the first time, I was with my colleague Adriano Forgione, and when we left Michael's apartment, we heard dolphin sounds all the way to the elevator, and we were looking around. We couldn't see where they were coming from, and when we called Michael the next day, he said, they followed you out the door. Didn't you see them? And I said, no, and they were gray beings also, that he said, and we heard these high-pitched sounds all the way out of his apartment, and I have Adriano use the word because he was with me, so I'm not crazy, so... And we had other things happening to us around Michael Wolff. So Michael Wolff is a huge story. I have to have a lot of time to write the book, like, you know, Paul Hallier wants me to write it. And someday the people will know that Michael Wolff was real.
Mm-hmm. What was the scenario he kind of outlined as far as the control of this subject inside the government, and, you know, where he fit in there and all of that?
Well, from what I understand, if you, and this is the same as Clifford Stone, if something happens and you are contacted as a child, and in Michael's case, his father was in the military, he told the father told the military about Michael's contact. I mean, his brother was also part of the contact that they had had. And Michael's IQ went way high up. And so his science teacher also reported Michael was a genius. All of a sudden, you know, out of the clear, he was such a genius that Michael in his book talks about being taken to Princeton University and his IQ being measured, and right away we have a very intelligent person with telepathic abilities who had contact, okay? So right from there on, he said that his mentor or teacher was someone called the puppet master. Well, the puppet master, Michael told me, was Jesse Jesus Angleton, the head of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew Angleton, and then I began doing research on Angleton, and Angleton was very interested in UFOs. So here we go. You know, he was with Angleton he worked for the intelligence community. His genius ability enabled him to develop methods. In his book, he talks about the mind control kind of situation. That we also going into other dimensions. I've talked to other witnesses where a lot of the military people wanted them to go into these dimensions to retrieve information. The gateway treatment that Michael talks about in his book was something he had developed to jump dimensions. And believe me, Michael Wolff was very strange. And so, you know, then from that point on, you know, he said he worked on the Star Wars program, the particle beam weapon stuff. Michael was very sorry that he worked on a lot of the things he worked on, but his ego got in the way. You know, he was like to prove how intelligent he was. And towards the end of his life, like a lot of these people that did a lot of negative things, they come clean and they're very sorry. And Michael wanted disclosure. But Michael was always afraid that if he would go over, he'd get shoved in prison. I remember one or two times when I put him on the radio or had people interview him, he'd say, I can't talk. They're going to put me in Danbury prison. I can't talk. Now, somebody that has that kind of paranoia is speaking the truth. I mean, he's basically taken a security oath. So he just said that, and he said something else to me that I'll never forget. He said, Paula, he said, we could tell the people the truth, he said, but when you pull the rug out from under them, you've got to replace it with something else. And, you know, I always remembered that, that maybe humanity can't handle the truth all in one shot and then have nothing to replace it with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and I think that's the interesting part about disclosure, and maybe we can kind of get into that too, is that I'm sure powers that be, you know, have something they do want to replace it with, but it's, you know, something that's a one thing we have to be careful of. Is it something that's based on truth or just self-serving?
Well, it's the dilemma of disclosure. Michael's book, The Catchers of Heaven, is going for $150 on eBay.
Try $300.
Yeah, it's $300.
Yeah.
I know. And I remember, it's a long story, because, I mean, there's so much to the story I can't even talk about, because Michael was controlled. The book, of course, is not going to be published again, because, you know, once he's gone, they want it out of the line. There are people thinking about him. It's like, but it's very hard to read, because, did you ever see the movie A Beautiful Mind?
I haven't. You know, people always ask me that. I've got to go see it.
Yeah, well, he was that. He was John Nash. He's a John Nash who thought that he was being followed and would see people, you know, and was involved in some of this secret stuff. Well, Michael was like that. He had a beautiful mind, beautiful person. Everybody that met Michael Wolff was in love with him. He just was a beautiful person, but... Mm-hmm. Very ill. The last 2 years that I talked to him, he was always bedridden, chain smoker. all I can say is you can get through that book. It's worth your while, but it's written on many different levels. He was an admirer of J.D. Salinger, Catcher in the Rye, Franny and Zoe, and so he tried to imitate a lot of that style. So it's hard to read. We translated that into Italian too, though, Alejandro.
Oh, really?
It went out in Italy. We translated the book. I have the Italian copy, same cover. The back cover is a picture of Sarah, who is the human tape alien. He's blonde haired, blue eyed, beautiful face. Michael told me that was a photograph from the military archives that he had. The government archives, and he. In the Italians fell in love with Michael Wolff. You go to Italy and you talk about Italian ufology, Michael Wolff in the book captured so many hearts of so many young people. They adored him. They just adored him. So in my career, I have two books that we translated into Italian that I'm really happy about with two people that are no longer with us.
Mm-hmm. And what is it? What are some of the things, though, that definitely for you take, you know, this case to be beyond a doubt for you that this is definitely legitimate and something that happened?
Well, because I went there in person and because I knew this person, the thing that upsets me a lot when we're talking about somebody like Michael Wolff or anybody is people make judgments without ever having met them. Or they will make a judgment because of their opinion. Michael Wolff, I visited him four times. The first time with Adriana Forgione, my colleague who absolutely believes. We had some strange paranormal things happening to us when we were there. And I brought my mother there. I went with her once. He was so fascinating that an Alitalia pilot, Max Poggi, and his wife went to visit Michael. And he would call them at their home in Rome and absolutely tell them what was in every room of their house. He would remote view everything in their house. He knew the details of who knew what. For instance, do you know Dick Criswell? Dick Criswell was working on the AlphaCom team with Michael, and he says he was on the other phone, a side of the phone. and he taped it when Michael briefed President Clinton and Al Gore together on the UFO question. So Michael had told me this, and, you know, I hardly believe, you know, sometimes you just don't digest things.
Mm-hmm.
And until Dick Criswell told me that, I didn't, you know it. I mean, Dick Criswell said he heard him. I mean, he was on the other side. Michael had a top secret clearance, so did Dick have a clearance. Then when that gentleman from Montreal called me and told me about the gray that walked out, and this gray being evidently was Colta, and picked up this gentleman's camera and took a picture of Michael and this gentleman, and he sent me the picture. And you can see the reflection of the gray in the picture behind Michael. You could see the being, because they had asked Michael to switch the pictures on the wall so that the reflection would be there. You could see the terrorized look in the guy's face, and Michael is smiling at the camera. It's like, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is all really true. I mean, this man actually saw the gray being. I heard them, but this man actually saw them. Michael was very involved with different races. I mean, his contact was with a small gray that looked like a baby gray named Colta. And then later on, he interacted with Sarah, which was a blonde, blue-eyed. And one of the things about his book that was really hurtful is that they tried to get the contactees to tell them what was the real story by using truth serum and other kinds of drugs to get into this, you know, into this other dimension. If you study the MKUltra program, I think they wanted to know some truth about the UFO phenomenon by using altered states, and you can do that with drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hoping to have Dick Criswell on eventually. I know he's very sick right now,
yeah,
but hopefully he'll get better here soon. Because I think, you know, this story is fascinating, and of course if it's true, there's some there's some information to be gathered that can be obtained there. Because I know I first learned of Criswell, well, through a friend of mine. And then the first time I was on Coast to Coast, they brought him along with me and I can't remember who else was on with me. I think the state director in Texas. And he talked about that. He talked about the briefing with Clinton and Gore. And I think George Knapp was interviewing us. And he was like, whoa. You know, we're talking about Stephenville here. So it's definitely some pretty interesting stuff.
Well, please talk to him, because what happened was when I met Michael, I didn't have the verification after he's dead. These people came out of the woodwork after he was dead and verified a lot of this stuff. And I was very honored to have gone there. Now, every time I went there about 3 to 4 times. I can't remember. I'll have to look at the dates. I paid for it myself. It cost me a mint to fly there, stay in a hotel 2 or 3 days and so forth, because I figured it was worth it. And every conversation I taped, I figured it was worth it. I didn't ever know what I was going to do with this, Alejandro, because I just collect information. I just
mm-hmm.
collect it. Someday, I guess I got to write a book about Michael Wolff. I mean, someday this will have to come out. And I'm really happy you're open-minded about it, because there are some researchers that have slammed the door on this without even bothering to have met the man.
Yeah, a lot of people get frustrated with Michael Wolff, some with Corso, and even more so with Billy Meyer. But there's a lot of these where, you know, unless there's something definitive. For me, I haven't seen anything definitive with any of those cases that proves they were definitely all false. It's kind of similar to Bob Lazar. Some of what he said is highly suspect, but the majority of it, and especially a lot of it, is impossible. You know, it's difficult to refute. And so, like you said earlier, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And these are all cases that are like that. Well, there's some truth, I think, in a lot of these.
Well, Billy Meyer is absolutely true. I'm not going to play games. I've been crucified over that, but I've met Billy Meyer. I saw Billy Meyer. I went there. I mean,
uh-huh.
One of the things that bugs me about people that make decisions, you can't just put a couple of pictures on Photoshop and say they're fake. why don't you go speak to the town? When we slept in the I went with three Italians. We went to a chalet hotel. Those people all saw those craft. I mean, they're talking to me about where we could go to Skywatch. I mean, they support the story 100%. The people that don't want you going there are the Swiss military government people. There was pilgrimages. The problem with Billy Meyer is cults and religions grow around contactees. And so there were pilgrimages. People would flock up to Switzerland, and they don't want that. They don't want you going up to Switzerland. They certainly don't want you going to see this stuff because these craft were photographed, and I saw where they were photographed, in the hills where they were photographed in movies. Six movies that the Japanese bought. You want to tell me how they faked a UFO over a highway just sitting there? Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no way of faking these 35-millimeter movies. But the Japanese knew, and they bought Billy Meyer's material because they know it's real. Now, when somebody like Billy Meyer, not what's his name, Wendell Stevens, does the case, it's been said, I know of Heralded Grant, but for me, Wendell Stevens is the greatest researcher on the planet, researching the most cases and being really clear about what he's done. He went there and he's told me what happened when he was with Billy Meyer. And, mm-hmm. He's seen things when he was there. He initially, with the elders, did the research on that, and he's Colonel Wendell Stevens. He's not going to be duped into some fake thing.
Yeah, so, he's a great researcher. I have a couple of interviews with him on my YouTube site, and actually on the front page of the blog talk, you can see that too. So for all you podcasters, go check out either my YouTube site or just go to UFO Think Tank. You can see him there too. But you know what? We've got 10 minutes, a little less than that left. And I want to talk to you about, especially because of your perspective, being so close with all of these European nations and doing so much out there, and I think you have a unique perspective on America and American disclosure. You know, you tell me a lot about this, and I'd like to kind of talk about that. America and disclosure. What do you think of that?
I don't want to be unpopular, but I don't think America's ever going to disclose. They have the most to lose. Plus, they have to go explain Roswell. You think they're going to go all the way back to 1947 and say, okay, those weren't crash dummies. That was real. They can't go backwards like that. It's too much to have to clean up. It's a mess that's gone this far. They're not going to be the ones to disclose, and I don't think Obama's ever going to take this on. Because I think it's heavy, too heavy. I see him really struggling with the economy thing and you know, it's survival. He's on survival mode. This would just, like it did to Dennis Kucinich, just doing that. You know, Shirley MacLaine mentions that Kucinich had an encounter and it's over for Kucinich. And the thing with the encounter, not the encounter, the sighting that Kucinich had was that this thing actually landed. He was sitting on the patio of Shirley MacLaine's house in New Mexico, and it was an incredible sighting. He had this thing landed, and it finished his career. So is it going to come from America? Not until, number one, we really need the technology. When we do away with fossil fuel technology and we can admit that we have this free energy technology, yes, maybe. The other thing that will make them, maybe, America open up a bit would be if we had three sightings over three major airports and the craft just sat there and you couldn't deny it. It would be game over. But the problem with game over is it would be interpreted as an invasion, so now we get our big guns, heavy guns, and start shooting them out of the skies. So it's a dilemma. I mean, every major country has opened up its files, including Denmark now. Has opened up its files. Why don't we jump into the mix? Mm-hmm. Because it's too heavy to take on. It's got nothing to do with the aliens, religion, or anything. It's just too big an issue. However, in support of Stephen Bassett, of Grant, and all the other people, we're not going to quit trying. I don't think you're going to quit trying. I'm not going to quit trying. We'll all keep doing it. It's just I don't think it's in the hands of the politicians. I think it's almost in the hands of the ETs.
Mm-hmm. And you call that the ET disclosure, disclosure with a little d? Is that true?
Well, I don't know. The ETs would have to be desperate to do it. It would have to be like, I believe somebody asked me once if there's going to be a nuclear, you know, bomb thrown over some big country, or if, you know, they were going to annihilate one country with a nuclear, would you see ETs? And I say, absolutely, absolutely. Mm. Would there be ET interference? Yes.
Mm,
yes,
interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's, when you think about it, it's almost strange that people haven't nuked each other already, seeing as how we have that technology, and it's unfortunately all over the place right now. Well, how is the attitude different in Europe? Since you do talks in the UK, right? You do talks all over the place.
Well, it's just who's there. I mean, here it's more of a party, and everybody goes to everybody's speech, and you buy a couple of books, you have a couple of beers, and everybody gets. In Italy, there's no T-shirts, there's no party, there's no selling anything. You go, and usually who's in the audience are science people, professors, professional people who are, you know, in the sciences, students, and they're very serious. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a serious discussion. Actually, it almost seems like an argument. It's such a serious discussion because the scientists that are there, you're completely destroying the whole notion of physics.
Well, see, we've only got a couple minutes, but I just got a caller. So let's see if we can get them in on time. You just got a couple seconds here, caller. So did you want to – is the caller online?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Hey there.
Can you
go ahead with your question?
And Iran in 1976, the UFOs and dogfight over Iran, Tehran. Do you know about that or not?
Yes, I do know about that. That is one of the most important cases ever, and we've talked about that at conferences. And that's been looked at by a lot of researchers too. The dogfight over Tehran, absolutely.
Yep, that's a big case. So thank you, caller. We've only got about a minute left here, so I want to thank Paula for being on. Do you want to mention the UFO Congress?
Yeah, I want to mention, if they want to read more on my website, it's www.paulaharris.com, and click on the UFO Congress up on the corner, and they have all the speakers of the Congress at Laughlin on the 28th of February. Till the 1st of March, and it's got everybody. We've got Stanton Friedman. It's got. We even have Ed Grimsley, who has night screening devices for you to do a sky watch. We have Haktan Hakatan from Turkey, Maurizio Bayada from Italy, Asia Gevard from Brazil. Heidi,
I love
Alcan.
His name too, Maurizio Bayada.
Yeah, and we have. What's his name? From Asia Gebhardt from Brazil, and Jaime, your friend Jaime Santiago Toria. They're going to be. These are the foreign people, and I think David Wilcox is coming back, and we have 30 speakers.
Cool.
So
and it's just UFOCongress.com, I think.
Yeah, but they can click on my website, and it goes right to it. Goes right to it.
Which is PaulaHarris.com.
Yeah.
Paula spelled P-A-O-L-A. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, yeah. Paula spelled P-A-O-L-A, Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S. And then I've also got the link on here. I've also got a link to your book on the blog talk. And unfortunately...
Well, I want to mention, too, the X Conference is coming on in Washington, and Edgar Mitchell will be there.
Oh, great.
Again, on the 17th of April, and we need to herald people of Edgar Mitchell.
Cool. So the X Conference also. Go check that out. All right. Well, we are down to seconds, so I've got to say thank you, Paula. We'll definitely have you on again. There's no doubt about that. But have fun out there in Laughlin. Hopefully some of the listeners will be out there to say hi. I know of a few that will. And keep up the great work. And I'm sure we'll be talking.
Thank you, Alejandro. You're a lot of fun. Thank you so much for everything you do.
No problem. Thank you.